This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Beyond Watson, a conversation on the use of analytics to meet government mission. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Decisions based on bad information can lead to poor results and be quite costly to organizations. This may culminate in the squandering of opportunities, taking unnecessary risks, misallocating resources, and ultimately not achieving strategic goals or objectives. At a time of shrinking budgets and increasing expectations to do more with less, making better decisions based on informed judgment has taken on even more significance for both public and private sector organizations. In a world inundated with all kinds of information, timely, relevant, and more predictive data can drive better decision-making. What is analytics? How can analytics identify patterns, provide critical insights, and enhance decision-making? In this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, we will explore these questions and so much more with two very special guests. Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College, kicks off this special edition with an in-depth conversation on the strategic importance of analytics and how government can leverage analytics to improve decision-making. In the second half of the show, David Shepler from IBM Research and Watson Project Manager joins me to discuss the real-life implications of the technology that is the acclaimed Jeopardy winner, Watson. What makes government such a natural fit for this type of innovation? First up, Professor Davenport on analytics and business intelligence.
Well, I really define analytics as systematic efforts to analyze data in a quantitative fashion. So that might be statistics, econometrics. Sometimes people get into textual analytics, particularly in the intelligence field. Anytime you use systematic analysis of data to help make a decision. Data mining is typically viewed as a subset of analytics. It's one of the things you can do in the analytical context. And analytics is really a subset of business intelligence. So I usually think of business intelligence, that's the broad category in the information technology field for what you do with data to help understand how your organization is performing and kind of what's going on in your business. And it consists of two things. There's reporting, which is simplified reports or queries or dashboards or scorecards, but that's all about the past and it's all about what happened last quarter, last month, and it doesn't really tell you anything about why something happened, and it doesn't go forward into the future at all. Analytics are the other part of business intelligence that starts to give you an understanding of why something happened, which is always useful, and then once you have a model that predicts the past, you can start predicting the future, and that's incredibly useful. So analytics, I think, is a more valuable activity than reporting, but you kind of need reporting before you can really get into analytics much.
Tom, government agencies don't compete, but they definitely have a use for strategic analytics. Would you describe how analytics and fact-based decision-making can assist government agencies?
Sure, Michael. There are a lot of opportunities, and I think while government organizations may not be competing on analytics, you're starting to see some evidence that they are beginning to transform themselves through the use of analytics. You see it in certain sectors. Certainly intelligence has often been about analytics, and they're heavy users of it and have been for a while. The big initiative there is how do we get different intelligence agencies in the United States to share all that data? Healthcare, huge issue right now. How do we use comparative effectiveness analytics to know which treatment is really most effective and most worth paying for? How do we use analytics to identify the patients who are most likely to contract diabetes, say? Diabetes and congestive heart failure account for only about 30% of the patients in Medicare, but they account for about 75% of the spending. So if we can identify a diabetes patient before they actually contract the disease and head it off through diet and exercise and behavior, you know, that's great for the government and great for the patient. So big initiatives in healthcare. Taxes, I'm afraid, are another area where analytics are pretty heavily used to kind of identify the people who might be underpaying or not paying at all their taxes and to go after them and to figure out really, you know, just as with other organizations, tax agencies have to segment their customers, so to speak, and identify the ones who are both most likely to be not paying and those who are most likely to be responsive when you're trying to collect, because you can't go after everybody with equal vigor. And then certainly in the military, there have always been a lot of analytical activities related to supply chain. The Army, in particular, very focused on kind of the human supply chain of how do we attract people to enlist in the first place and who's most likely to stay with us over time so we can kind of focus our efforts on keeping the people in who we think have a good chance of doing that. But all sorts of opportunities, I think, but still early days.
Tom, would you elaborate in the areas where you see the most effective use of analytics?
I think certainly for, you know, to make healthcare reform really work, we're going to have to, you know, not just insure more people and make it possible to get health insurance even if you have a pre-existing condition, but we're going to have to get better at how we actually provide healthcare. And analytics are often the key to that. You have some private healthcare institutions like Intermountain Healthcare in Utah, Partners Healthcare in my neck of the woods in Boston, that have done some great work at embedding evidence-based medicine into actual day-to-day practice. So at Partners, for example, they have a semi-automated system that has care protocols that have been, you know, validated through statistics and research that, you know, if a patient comes in with a certain set of conditions, the system is going to recommend that the physician give a certain drug or follow a certain care protocol. Now, the physician can override, and that's pretty important, I think, in medicine, because the physician may know something that the system doesn't. But increasingly, we're going to do evidence-based medicine and not leave it up to humans to remember all of that, but embed it into systems. And that's what the VA did early on with their electronic medical record system. And increasingly, the leading private healthcare institutions are doing the same thing. Still a small percentage, but that's definitely the direction that it's going. In Medicare and Medicaid, the focus is, as you suggested, disease management to identify the really expensive cases that we can might be able to head off a little bit or at least treat more effectively, and then to identify fraud. Obviously, Medicaid is going to be done at the state level since that's how it's administered. Medicare is going to be done more at the federal level, and a lot of activity, obviously much more fragmented for Medicaid, but a lot of activity in both cases to eliminate fraud for people who, you know, file claims or whatever that don't really deserve to be paid back for them.
Analytics is playing an increasingly critical role in government revenue management. Tom, would you tell us more about the analytical applications in the revenue management area?
Sure. So the general feeling is that there's this phenomenon called the tax gap, which is the gap between what we should be paying and what we're actually paying. And most people tend to believe it's about 15%. So obviously that leads to a pretty big number if you can increase that through analytics. And so the IRS for a number of years, actually a couple of decades, has been identifying people who are not paying what they probably should be paying based on what other factors sectors. We know about them. It's called the Taxpayer Compliance Measurement Program. It probably could be a little bit more aggressive. I think the payoffs from doing analytical work in revenue management tend to be huge, roughly tenfold. So if I were a congressman, I would send money to the IRS to do analytical work because it really pays off in a big way. Sweden is probably, of all the tax authorities around the world, is probably the most aggressive one we found at using analytics to not only identify people who don't pay enough, but really to kind of build confidence in the tax authorities that, you know, the rules make sense and that people are encouraged to perform the right behaviors as far as their taxes are concerned. A lot of tax problems are errors, not criminal intent. And I guess a big part of that confidence in the tax agency is confidence that they'll get you if you don't pay what you're supposed to. But they've really built their strategy around it. And as far as we can tell, are the most aggressive revenue management agency. A lot of state work in that regard, too, in the United States. Massachusetts, my state, unfortunately, is they haven't come after me yet, but someday they probably will. Really big on using analytics. Texas is another one. So a lot of, you know, isolated efforts at the states in that regard.
And Tom, in your report for the IBM Center for the Business of Government titled Strategic Use of Analytics in Government, you outlined the Delta model for assessing analytic capability. Would you describe the model and how these traits apply to the public sector?
I think, you know, even if you're just listening to the radio, you can remember this fairly easily. So D is for data. As you suggested earlier, Michael, you got to have good data. And organizations that are really competitive about this tend to think a lot about, well, what might be something new or unique that I don't have already in terms of data that could really help this process? So that might be at Harrah's, it's how frequently do the employees smile at customers. That's apparently a big driver of customer satisfaction. So they measure smile frequency. Postal Service has got a big effort to measure how long it actually takes time in transit to get a package through and what percentage of the time does it meet their standards. So getting that data is a big first step. E is for enterprise, and we found that when companies compete on analytics, they tend to view analytics as an enterprise, not as a bunch of little localized silos. So that's combining data, that's combining analytical people in many cases, and also combining, you know, technology and technology solutions. L in the Delta model is for leadership, probably the single most important thing. So, you know, if you've got somebody leading the charge, you'll do very well. In government, I think the best example of that is when Dr. Ken Kaiser was head of the VA, really led the charge on putting electronic medical records in place and starting to do things like disease management and so on with that data. T is for target. So where's your focus? For the VA, it's probably going to be on something involving patient care. For the Postal Service, it's probably going to be around something related to logistics as a primary target, because that's where you spend all your money and that's what creates your performance. For a private sector organization like a Harrah's, it's on customer loyalty. So eventually, analytical orientations can kind of spread out into a variety of areas, but you need to start with a target. And then finally, A is for analysts. If you want to be highly analytical, you need to either have some internal capabilities, or you need to find them somehow. You know, maybe consultants or contractors can help in that regard, but you need some people who are able to think analytically, who can do the data analysis for you, and even more important, who can communicate effectively with decision makers about what the numbers say. So one of my research organizations calls that, you know, PhDs with personality. It's great to have the math skills, but you also need to be able to communicate and build trust among decision makers. The successful CEOs tend to be people who were analytical all along, and they just made it to CEO, or they were viewed as being somebody who could bring this orientation in. You know, the guys at Capital One were analytically oriented consultants before they started the company. Gary Loveman at Harrah's was a business school professor and used analytics in his work. So the good news is that more and more people have been trained in this in schools. And so, you know, many of them forgot about it by the time they got up to be near the CEO level. But it's not that hard. You just need to ask questions about, you know, what are the assumptions behind this model? Are there any circumstances under which it doesn't work? Basically, as Gary Loveman says, you have to push back and ask occasionally obnoxious questions about, you know, where's the data? What's your source of evidence for this? Should we go gather some more data? And, you know, what do the data suggest? And do you think that we have a, you know, frame the decision in the right way in the first place? That's part of the job, is just framing the question right in the first place and examining lots of alternatives.
What does the future hold for the use of strategic analytics in government? We'll explore this area with Tom Davenport when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring how analytics can assist government agencies to meet mission. I'm here with Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Tom, what advice would you have for government leaders to leverage the right amount of analytics?
Well, if you look at the Delta model, Michael, I think The D is not a problem. There's plenty of data in many agencies. There may have to be some remedial work, but there's enough to work on, I suspect. The E is an issue in government because we tend to be pretty fragmented in most agencies. The analytical people aren't talking to each other. You know, in the intelligence community, they're working on that, and having a Directorate of National Intelligence, one of the things they're trying to do is to share more information and be more enterprise-oriented with regard to analytics, but I think still a long way to go. The L word is probably the biggest problem, in that we don't have enough highly analytical leaders in government who are able to really press for this and devote the resources to it and so on. So I'm hoping that somehow they will emerge fairly soon. Targets thing is not that tough. I think for most government agencies, they can figure out, you know, where are the most fruitful targets. I was talking to some of the people in the Social Security Administration, and for them, you know, one of the initial targets for analytics was giving people who are disabled benefits as soon as possible, you know, really speeding that process along. So, you know, that's a natural result for an organization that's really, you know, trying to help its constituents. Finally, the A word for analysts, in a way, it's a problem because there aren't that many in government. Less of a problem because you can fairly easily procure them externally. A number of the Medicaid fraud organizations go outside and work with contractors on that. But I think the key in government, particularly in the intelligence sector, is we call people analysts who aren't very analytical. There have been a couple of studies recently suggesting that in the CIA and the NSA and so on, the analysts tend to rely more on intuition and experience more than analytics, despite the fact that, you know, we have a vast amount of data that's being analyzed at places like the NSA. I'm not sure that enough of that serious analytical work actually gets used in analyst reports, and even less so in policymaker decision making. So at the start of the funnel, we do really well. At the end of the funnel, where it comes to analysts and decision makers, not so well with our analytical orientation in government.
Tom, what are some next steps in implementing analytics in the government sector?
Well, I think there will be even more appetite for this going forward. If I were primarily focused on government, I think what I would try to do is develop some capability to educate senior policy makers on the value of this kind of approach and what their responsibilities are. I mean, this is not just something that the analysts can do by themselves. executives need to ask the right questions, need to kind of push back when they don't understand something. That was another problem, by the way, in the financial crisis, is you had executives buying into models that they didn't really understand. And so, you know, when things went south, they didn't know what to do about it. So I think in areas that we know are going to be big over the next several years, like healthcare, identifying what are some of the key analytical approaches that make sense, what are the key analytical targets, what should the government really be enforcing. One of the things that's happening in the health IT space is that you're going to get money for doing an electronic medical record if you're a hospital or physician's office, but part of what they're calling meaningful use of those technologies is thinking about using analytics as well. You know, how do you use the data to make better decisions about healthcare? So that, I think, is definitely going to be shaping some of the thinking in the government space. If I were in intelligence, I'd be focusing on getting the analysts to be more analytical and using some of that vast stream of data. So it differs by target area and, you know, different kinds of agencies and so on. But I think one of the great things about the Obama administration is they seem to care about data, transparency, evidence-based decision-making and so on. You know, whether they will ultimately make better decisions, who knows? But I at least like some of the processes that they are following.
Tom, how can strategic analytics assist companies and private sector organizations to better collaborate?
Well, that's one of my hobby horses, actually. I don't know if you knew that. I haven't written much about it yet. But my view is that we can get data on collaboration if we really want it. Most of the tools, you know, Lotus Notes, certainly, and many of the other tools that people have for collaboration, they sort of keep track of who's collaborating with whom. And so I'm starting to noodle around an idea called the science of collaboration that says if we're really serious about it, just as a lot of private sector businesses are quite serious about looking at who comes to their web page, you know, in terms of customers and so on, how long do they spend there, where do they come from, et cetera, so-called web analytics, we can do all that with collaboration too. And I think if we're serious about collaboration, we'll start to treat it as something we need to measure and something that really can there can be a science to.
You outline a framework for improving decision-making. Would you elaborate on that framework?
Sure. So it's a 4I framework. It's not like Delta. It's not an acronym. But the first I is really to identify what are your key decisions. I mean, when I go around and talk to organizations, I say, you know, do you know what your top 10 or top 15 or top 20 decisions are? And very few do. And, you know, I think we can't make all of them better. So we should identify which ones, both a strategic perspective and an operational perspective, which ones are really critical to our effective performance. So then for those, you start taking a look at them, and I call that the inventory stage. So how well are they made today on average? How long do they take? Who's involved in them? You know, get a sense of how broken they are, how much opportunity there is for improvement, if you will. And then the third stage is to intervene in them. And maybe the difficult thing these days is there are a lot of possible interventions that most organizations haven't taken advantage of. You know, one being if we're going to do a lot of that particular decision, we can automate it to some degree. So that's one of the things that the Social Security Administration is doing with regard to disability claims. If it seems like a clear, open and shut case that a person has a disability and we want to get it through the system very quickly, might as well make that decision in an automated or at least a semi-automated fashion so you can get it done. I think IBM has been working with them on that particular project. Another would be just to think about who's involved in the decision and should it be a little bit broader. One of the things the Obama administration is trying to do is to get more, you know, public input into decision making. Another would be thinking about, you know, the mix of emotion and intuition and rationality in it. So there's some decisions like moral decisions, that emotion seems to be absolutely essential to it. People lose the emotional part of their brain, they can't make those decisions at all, whereas other decisions for which there's data available and for which, you know, the stakes are high really probably should not be purely intuition-based. So the intervention step is really stepping back and saying, what can we do to make this decision better? And then finally, there's an institutionalization process to say, okay, if we really care about making decisions better, what are the things we can put in place, like a set of decision analysts or coaches, like a process for looking back at how decisions turn out, that could really make us get better at this over the long run?
How do you balance and augment decision tools like modeling with human intuition and judgment?
Well, that's a real interest of mine, and I think there are some things that analytics are really good at, but there's some things that humans are really good at. And analytics are not really good at knowing when they don't apply anymore. And computers obviously are doing that work, and they are not going to give you a recommendation. Please turn me off. You know, the conditions no longer prevail that I can make a decision well here. So humans are good at that kind of big picture thinking and kind of noticing changes in the environment. And so we should use our brains for that kind of purpose. There's an airline pilot who's a friend of mine who I sometimes go sailing with. And he was one day telling me, we were talking about analytics, and he said, oh yeah, we have plenty of analytics in the airline business these days. We have green screens, we call them, and avionics and fly-by-wire systems and so on. But he said, I still find it useful to look out the window every now and then. And so I think that's really what we have to do. We have to, you know, keep our eye on the computers and the instruments and so on, but also look out the window to say, is there really something happening here that makes these analytical tools not as useful as they might be? Is there a black swan coming up, as Nassim Taleb calls it? You know, I think most swans are white, and so analytics in that sense, normal statistical distributions can be pretty useful, but there's sometimes when a normal distribution doesn't apply, and you need to have your eye out for those all the time.
Tom, what does the future hold for the use of analytics?
Well, we know where there are going to be more and more sources of data. So, every time you walk down the street, you're generating video data increasingly. And from an intelligence and a crime prevention standpoint, we're not going to be able to analyze all of that with humans, just way too much footage. So there will be analytics of video, I think, to identify where there are crime and intelligence issues that need interventions. Every time something moves throughout an organization, a piece of inventory or a human being, we can do supply chain analytics on it and can kind of optimize the movement. And, again, coming back to collaboration, if we want to really maximize collaboration among people, let's design our workplace so that the people who need to collaborate tend to see each other a lot. All we know now is that if you put them a long way from each other, that doesn't work very effectively. But, you know, how close do they need to be, and how can you kind of engineer the flow of people to get them to collaborate a little bit better? So I think we'll do more of that kind of thing. Certainly we'll have all these radio frequency ID devices around that are generating vast amounts of information about where every piece of inventory or materiel in a defense perspective is, and how we can predict its location much more accurately and just manage all of that data. There'll be more and more communications data to manage for intelligence agencies, more and more health data as we get electronic medical records around the country, and every medical device has, you know, some sensor attached. We'll know whether people are taking their prescriptions or not. Men are particularly bad. They only take about 50% of their prescriptions on average. But if we know that, we can start to send them messages, or maybe someday we'll have little, I don't know, electrical stimuli saying, "I'll shock you if you don't take your pill, pal." Could be somewhat Orwellian if we're not careful there, of course.
Skinner,
but
would love.
Yeah, exactly. A behavior modification device. But there's going to be a vast amount of data. And if we're not going to get overrun by it. We really need to use analytics to digest it, to make sense of it. All of this data at some point was intended to make better decisions in organizations. So analytics aren't the only tool, but they're a very powerful tool for digesting and reducing the amount of data and learning from all of the data that we have in our organization.
Just as growing numbers of private sector firms have begun to make analytics the core of their strategies, government organizations can also put this powerful resource at the center of their efforts to achieve their missions. Analytics uses data, structured and unstructured, to uncover patterns, identify opportunities, seek parallels, formulate predictions, and inform decisions. It has the potential to transform information into insights, taking diverse volumes of data and predicting the most likely outcomes of key decisions or events. These insights can make a real difference and enhance an organization's performance, from doctors managing treatment better to the Social Security Administration adjudicating disability claims more quickly and accurately. Success is all about turning analytics into action. All of this rests on having access to quality data, robust algorithms, sufficient computation power, and strong leadership. It is in this capacity to predict trends, anticipate events, and identify risks that makes analytics a potentially valuable tool for today's government leaders. What possibilities does IBM's Watson Deep QA hold for public sector organizations? We'll explore this and so much more with David Scheppler from IBM Research when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? How are disruptive innovations saving lives on the battlefield and expanding our presence in space? What is the U.S. Navy doing to strengthen its information dominance for the 21st century? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? And how are federal agencies leveraging technology to improve mission effectiveness? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from those who lead. Hear from Richard Spires, leading Homeland Security's technology effort, Dr. Bobby Braun, advancing NASA's space technology program, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance, and Cass Holloway, ensuring the New York City water system is viable for the next 100 years. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring how analytics technology can assist government agencies to meet mission. We turn now from providing analytics a proper context, highlighting its potential, as well as its very real benefits, to introducing you to a sort of case study, its technological application that is IBM's Watson. IBM's Watson is far more than a Jeopardy contestant or winner. It promises to be much more than a marketing gimmick, or simply a fad. At first glance, answering questions for a game show seems far removed from the work that government does, but there are significant and promising parallels to government work. David Scheppler from the IBM research team and Watson project manager joins us now. David, how did the Watson Jeopardy Challenge come about? What's the history and genesis of this effort?
The genesis of the project really began back in Ken Jennings' run on Jeopardy. An IBM executive, a guy named Charles Lickle, who was the vice president overseeing this team that eventually built Deep QA or Watson. He was in a bar watching Ken Jennings run and thought, geez, I wonder if we could build a system that could kind of take on this task of playing the game of Jeopardy. In 2007, David Ferrucci stepped forward, the principal investigator of Deep QA, or the lead research scientist, formed a small team and began to tackle it. Probably a year or two thereafter, they recognized that the system was on a trajectory to be competitive, and we decided to approach Jeopardy seriously with the idea of potentially having a competition. So the system continued to be developed, tweaked, improved over a four-year period, and as of last fall or so, we would say that the system really reached competitive level performance and was ready to take on, you know, a player of the caliber of Ken Jennings and Brad. bad rudder. So it really took about 4 years to get the system there. Over the last couple of years, we put it through a really extensive kind of real-world game testing regime. We invited in nearly 100 former Jeopardy contestants to take Watson on. Watson held its own and continued to improve over that time until ultimately we established kind of our final record of achievement as of last November, when we were able to beat Jeopardy Tournament of Champions semifinalists and finalists. We brought in about 40 of that caliber of player. We conducted 55 games, and Watson was able to win or place first in 71% of them. So we really consider that to be our formal record of achievement, you know, sort of the crowning accomplishment of the Jeopardy Challenge task in Watson. Yeah, Watson was chosen because T.J. Watson is both the founder of the company, of IBM, as well as, obviously, the person who created IBM Research. So it made a lot of sense to take that Watson name and sort of the ultimate recognition and put that name on this this technology or this character.
David, how did Watson actually work as a contestant in Jeopardy?
The question of how does Watson play the game in Jeopardy, you can break it down to sort of the various system components that exist in it, right? So we have the what we call the back end, the real deep QA engine, which is where the really important stuff is. And this is what actually performs the question-answer task. But there is a thing called the front end that does kind of a lot of these other things, that does the strategy, you know, clue selection, that speaks the answers to the clues, that does the wagering and so forth, and sends the signals out to try to buzz in and receive signals about whether the buzzer has been enabled. So we can really talk about this in terms of those two different things, the back end, deep QA engine, and this front end that sort of does all of the physical manifestation of the game, right? The front end is kind of the fun part of it. First, we have to have a visual presence as well as a speaking presence to stand up there and quote-unquote, and act as a Jeopardy contestant. So we've built an avatar that you've seen on the show that is the IBM Smarter Planet logo with some animations on it that respond to different states of the game. It cheers when it gets something right. It kind of looks a little bit down when it misses a question. It looks left and right when the human contestants are answering questions and responds like a visualizer as it's speaking. You see the animations kind of jump around like what you would often see with kind of representations of speech. We have a text-to-speech engine that translates the text of the answers into the voice of Watson. The strategy component, which also sits in the front end, decides all the kind of important game-playing moves, decides what categories and clues to go after, decides if it wants to try to hunt down a daily double, for example, decides what it wants to wager when it does find the daily double and in Final Jeopardy, and that's obviously a really important piece of this. So it does all that kind of stuff. And the other important piece is sort of what we call Watson's hand or Watson's finger. For a while in the early days, Watson would buzz in electronically, would send a signal to the Jeopardy game control system that said, I want to answer this question. There was a lot of discussion about that. Does that give Watson an unfair advantage and so forth? So we decided to just kind of set that whole discussion aside and create a physical buzzer, a solenoid that would sit on the exact same buzzer or signaling device that the humans use. So you'll see this. I'm sure you've seen it in the game already, perhaps.
I understand the analytics technology underpinning Watson can deliver information efficiently and, more importantly, in everyday terms. This makes it easier for government agencies to find critical knowledge buried in huge volumes of natural language content that they grapple with each day. Would you tell us more about the underlying technology, the Deep QA, that is Watson?
Deep QA is a bundle of deep analytics that this team has developed. It applies the latest advances in natural language processing, machine learning, knowledge representation and reasoning. All these terms are ones often used in the kind of computer science discipline. But there are a whole bunch of very advanced algorithms in these areas that, when wrapped together, can provide extraordinary accuracy and understanding of confidence on the part of the system to produce natural language answers in response to a natural language question or query. The way that the the deep QA architecture functions is it receives as input the clue, the Jeopardy clue, and the associated category. It then decomposes that or parses it into to begin to understand the language, to identify ultimately the type of thing that is being asked for, to understand the subject and the predicate, the modifiers, all that kind of language stuff. Then it goes out and, using some shallow search techniques, casts the net very wide and looks for hundreds of potential candidate answers that might satisfy that clue and are of that type. With each of those candidates, it then explores in parallel, and this is a really important point, the architecture is built to operate in a massively parallel way, to take these hundreds of candidate answers and go explore the evidence, looking for evidence that supports each hypothesis or candidate answer, and evidence that perhaps rejects that particular hypothesis or answer. So it employs all sorts of advanced, cutting-edge, state-of-the-art algorithms and natural language processing and other techniques to begin to assess each of those candidate answers. Then, using machine learning techniques, it then combines all of the results, all the evidence, all the candidates, and ultimately merges it into a ranked list of candidate answers with associated confidences. And, of course, Watson will always answer with its most confident answer. So that's, in a nutshell, how it works and employs natural language processing, algorithms, machine learning, search, etc. And it's important to recognize that all of that is done in typically 3 seconds or even less, because in order for Watson to compete at Jeopardy, it's got to be able to produce answers in that time frame if it's going to have a chance to outbuzz its human competitors. In order to be able to achieve that massively parallel computation, and to do it in 3 seconds or better if possible, we had to employ a pretty advanced computer. The computer we chose was the IBM Power 750 or Power 7 system. We used 2,880 cores. That's roughly equivalent, although it's not really a true apples-to-apples comparison. You can roughly think of that as about using 6,000 kind of high-end desktop computers. So this is quite a hefty system. Now, it's important to recognize that this system is commercially available. It's not a customized system like Deep Blue was, tailored to the research task. This was built on commercially available IBM servers.
David, would you describe more broadly analytics in the Watson Deep QA context?
Analytics broadly is about trying to manage in a smart way the data of an organization, right? To more deeply understand that data. In this context, we're talking about how do you deal with and take advantage of a large body of natural language data. So we're not talking about structured databases necessarily. We're talking about content as you as a human might engage it, books and journals and magazines and emails and all sorts of things like that. How does an enterprise, how does an organization deal with the sort of data deluge? So in this case, we're talking about a specific kind of capability, text analytics, and to be able to manage that, to be able to find the content that is of interest to you in a very human way, in using natural language.
What possibilities does IBM's Watson Deep QA hold for public sector organizations? We'll explore this and so much more with David Schepler from IBM Research when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. Brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Today we'll be focusing on the Global Partnership Initiative at the U.S. Department of State with Rob Latka, who is the Global Partnership Initiative Liaison at State. Rob, welcome. There has been a significant shift in the source of development assistance. I understand that in the 1960s, some 70% of all money flowing from the United States to the developing world was official development assistance. That is different today, with almost 80% coming from private sources. Could you give us a sense of why that's happened? What are the trends that have contributed to the significant shift?
Yeah, that statistic just blows my mind, too. And the really interesting thing about it, Michael, is that even though it's gone from 70% going all the way down to 20%, the interesting thing is that that number's actually gone up. It's just the pie has increased that much. And so what I'm trying to say is that you have so much more private money that's flowing abroad. You've gone from official development assistance being the bulk of it during the Kennedy administration when they set up USAID and they sent all this money abroad, to we're still sending lots more money, and even on a per-dollar basis in real terms. But the real issue is that the private sector has just been sending so much money more to developing world, and it's not just businesses. It's foundations, it's philanthropies, it's faith-based groups, it's remittances. 25% of that entire figure is remittances, or possibly more, because we can't really track it. And so there's some really interesting ways you can engage those dollars. One project that USAID just released is the Africa Diaspora Marketplace. It's a fascinating engagement where they basically took ideas from Africa saying, how do you engage diaspora communities in more meaningful ways? And it's a partnership with Western Union. It's Western Union's core business. It's perfect for USAID because it's helping to leverage new assets that we wouldn't be able to harness otherwise. And it's really finding ways to be at the cutting edge of globalization and use those trends to the advantage of development and the advantage of diplomacy, rather than letting those trends happen and then trying to catch up with them. And so it really is a case where, because so many dollars are going abroad in completely different ways, how do we engage with that and how do we maximize that for our foreign policy goals?
I had a question for you. In what ways does the GPI seek to address certain global health issues? Would you elaborate on any partnerships you have going on now?
There are two that come to mind. One is one that we've just been supporting with a group called the Center for Interfaith Action. And this is a group that's working in Nigeria through a group called NIFA, which is the Nigerian Interfaith Action Association. These folks are just terrific. And one of the things that they're doing is they realized Nigeria is 50% Muslim, 50% Christian. They don't have real reasons to work together in some cases, but there are things that they can agree on, and it's something like malaria. How can we engage them to work across faith lines on common concern? It's interfaith partnerships for the common good. And the way that they ended up doing it was they distributed these bed nets through faith leaders. I mean, they basically got the head imam and the head priest to work together on a partnership that, I mean, it's one of the most amazing stories that hasn't been told yet, where they're distributing these bed nets. And if you think about it, if you're using a bed net in your home, it's a ritual. It's a part of your daily ritual. Who influences rituals more than faith leaders? And who are the people who make it a part of your values, who say, this is something I want you to pass down to your children? You know, this is something that really the only way we're going to be able to influence, you know, all the people to do the sorts of things that we need them to do is to influence the influencers and to really change the way that people interact. Because, I mean, here's the thing. A faith leader is the person who brings you into this world for the most part around the world. They bring you into the world and they celebrate your arrival. They help you grow up. They teach you a lot of the values you learn as you go. They celebrate your marriage and they celebrate all the great points in life, and then they're there to see you go as you leave. And if we're not engaging with people who are helping in each of those areas, particularly when you have so many people that are dying of malaria unnecessarily, it's simply an issue of organization. We beat it here in the United States because we could organize around it. Why can't we beat it in countries like Nigeria? It's a system of organization that is already in place if you engage the faith leaders. So, I mean, that's one example I particularly love. The other is Phones for Health, which is a program that is just terrific. And it's our PEPFAR team has a particular unit that does public-private partnerships. British Robinson over there is just terrific. And one of the things British has been working on is this program where they distribute Motorola and Voxiva, distribute these cell phones to the regional leaders, the tribe leaders, in certain countries, and they will use these cell phones to beam up information about the blood tests that are being taken, so that people will take the drugs for HIV/AIDS, and then to find out if they're actually taking the triple cocktail or not, you come back, you beam it up through the cell phone, it's reported to a centralized database, it's tracking to each individual. Through cell phones, you have better reporting on HIV/AIDS tests, in terms of how the drugs are working, where they're working, where they might be being sold in terms of on the black market or whatever else. And so you have better healthcare reporting because you have the cell phone system that's able to centralize it into a database. Now, one of the most amazing things about this is it's also good marketing for Voxiva, Motorola, because they're getting their products into the hands of the influencers in these villages. And so it really is one of those things where we can move the ball so much further down the field if we just try and figure out who else we can work with on the same team. And so it really is one of those cases where you engage the private sector on the core business, you embrace that core business, and you find out ways to be innovative towards our development goals.
Wonderful perspective. Thanks for joining us today, Rob.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring how analytics technology can assist government agencies to meet mission. I'm joined by David Scheffler from IBM Research and Watson Project Manager. While the computing system won't replace human beings, it can give us a view of how technology can help us make better decisions and improve how government helps its citizens. David, what makes government such a natural fit for this type of innovation? Would you give us an example of where this technology is useful in the public sector?
That I would use about the public sector is the broader one, which is we know that all the large organizations that comprise, in particular, the federal government, have so much data that they have to manage, and much of that expressed in natural language, emails and documents and memos and so forth. So any tools and capabilities that can be developed that will help the analyst or the decision maker go find those nuggets of information that are of value to them at their fingertips would be of tremendous value. And we've heard this time and time again from various domains of the public sector, again from the health side, Health and Human Services, to the Department of Defense, to the intelligence community, to you name it. We even talked to the sort of Social Security Administration and the IRS. All the organizations have that same common problem. The details of their data and the domains that they operate in obviously vary and would mean potentially different type versions of this sort of capability. But the general problem is pretty universal across the public sector.
Would you tell us more about the applicability of the deep QA technology to healthcare delivery?
Well, we're exploring a number of applications, and the book is certainly not closed on these applications. We're listening to lots of different ideas around what would be the first applications to go tackle with this deep QA technology. Anything that provides this level of analytics and depth might really allow them to kind of manage this data deluge problem that all institutions, in particular the very large institutions, have to deal with. And government is certainly no exception to that. In fact, perhaps in many respects, their problems are greater than most. So they see that a tool like this or a capability like this might be really useful. You could imagine all sorts of applications in this space, in the government space. I can tell you that one of the ones we're very, very much interested in is pursuing something in healthcare, the medical space, perhaps a tool that allows a medical provider to deal with large volumes of medical information to help come up with differential diagnoses for a patient. So imagine instead of a Jeopardy question being presented to the system, instead you're offering the system a set of presenting symptoms, perhaps medical history, again expressed in natural language, and the system would be asked to sort of read all the journal articles and textbooks and medical information in its data corpus to come up with a ranked list of differential diagnoses. And the other aspect of that that's sort of interesting and different from Jeopardy is we would very much imagine a dialogue occurring. See, in the game of Jeopardy, there is no dialogue. A question is posed, and Watson has to come back with an answer. And then it's done, and it moves on to the next query, right? The next Jeopardy clue. In the case of medicine, we